This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time, in one way or another, we seem to get around to what it means to be human, and how through craft that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Marie Mutsky-Mockett, author of the novel The Tree Doctor.
I think it's pretty hard to fake genuine interest. So the one thing I can say is that I did have, in the moment, at the time that I was writing this, a genuine interest in all of these things that I was writing about. That's one of those secret ingredients to writing, I think.
We'll be back with Marie Mutsky-Mockett after these essential words. Here's what I want to say about pitching for patrons. It's my least favorite thing to do, but it supports my most favorite thing to do. Share this podcast with the world and with you. And so I'm wondering, do you get something out of this? Do you listen more than 8 times a year? Is there something of value for you in these episodes? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then why not support this content by becoming a patron of First Draft? You can do that at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Here's the common conversation I have at parties. Okay, I don't really go to parties because I'm always doing this, but this is a common conversation I have about this podcast. So why did you start this? Someone asks. I don't really know. I was a radio reporter for years and getting my MFA in fiction, and I missed interviewing people. So I combined these two things and started this show. I didn't really think about what I was doing. I didn't have a master plan. It just seemed like a fun idea at the time. And I still don't really have a master plan, but it's been 10 years that I've been doing this. So then they asked, do you make money? And the answer is, I have some incredible patrons, but they come and go. And lately, for whatever reason, and this is really vulnerable here, more people have left than joined. I can't pretend to know why, but in exit surveys, they usually say it's for financial reasons and that they really love the content. And I get that. I really get it because there are expenses to make this podcast and financial needs to make this podcast. I will say that every hour I'm working on this is time I'm not spending at a quote unquote paying gig. Times have changed since we got our newspapers on our stoops twice a day. You know that. Our content comes from all over the place. But in this case, there isn't an AI behind this, just an I, which is me, Mitzi, all by my lonesome, doing the research, booking the guests, reading their work, conducting the interview, uploading it into the podcast world, and then doing it again and again and again, more than 50 times in the last year. I produce one episode a week, and that is on top of all my other jobs, which is why I don't go to parties or really do anything on the weekends except for this. So if you value this podcast, please consider supporting it with a financial contribution. Membership starts at $6 a month and includes extras like writing tips, cuts that didn't make it into the final show, end of the year thank you gifts, ad-free, pitch-free episodes so you won't have to hear this again, and more. I think in this world, we have to support what we love, and there is an energy there that comes back to us. So please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters and become a supporter of First Draft today. It still doesn't make a shred of sense that I'm doing this podcast. Still, here I am after a decade. But Rumi said, set your life on fire. Seek those who fan your flames. So I'm inviting you to warm yourself by this fire and bring your fan along. Patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. And on to the show. My guest today is Marie Mutsky-Mockett, author of the novel Picking Bones from Ash and two books of nonfiction, American Harvest, which won the Nebraska Book Award, and Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye, which was a finalist for the Penn Open Book Award. She teaches at the Bennington Writing Seminars and is based in Tokyo, Japan. Her new novel is The Tree Doctor. We began the discussion with Marie Mutsky-Mockett sharing how she began writing her novel, and then I gave a description of the plot.
It's so hard to put myself back into that period of time, in my memory, this novel just sort of happened as I was talking to you, because I spoke to you after American Harvest published in April of 2020. And by May of 2020, I was working on The Tree Doctor kind of in my spare time, sort of clinging to it because the pandemic had happened. I wasn't going to go around doing some of the fun events that we had planned for American Harvest. And I was trying to distract myself. I know I was teaching remotely my class at St. Mary's College. I was a visiting professor in their MFA program, and I was teaching, I think, fiction along with workshop. And one of the books we read was The End of the Affair by Graham Greene. And it had been a while since I'd read it. And I remember thinking, oh, this novel is short. It takes place in a very limited geography. It has a very small cast of characters. And I think it occurred to me, I wonder if I could write fiction again if I wrote something with a very small cast of characters in a limited space. And then The Tree Doctor sort of just happened in my head, and I had the idea for the novel.
So I'll give a brief summary and you can correct me if I miss something. Your main character, who is the narrator, has two children and lives in Hong Kong with her husband, two daughters, and she's come back to the place of her birth in Carmel to take care of her aging mother, who is Japanese or half Japanese. Mm-hmm. And she, because she's in her childhood home, she's having all these memories, and her parents had this incredible garden with fruit trees and flowers and really significant, beautiful trees. And she ends up having a relationship with a man who works at the local nursery. She went there to buy some plants and get a little bit of advice, and he ends up entering her life, and they have this affair while she's teaching this online class of Tale of the Genji and communicating with her family from afar, but is also very adrift in this pandemic period where she's isolated. And I think the affair that she has with this man awakens something in her that she had lost. And it was very erotic. It's in midst of this pandemic, but also some wildfires. And her trying to figure out her identity, I think, as a woman in between caretaking for her mom, mm-hmm. who she can't see very often, and her family from afar. And so it's really about her connection to the natural world and herself.
That's great. Yeah. I think that's pretty accurate.
Yeah. So one of the aspects of her character is that she's there to care for her mom. And it's frustrating for her because she can't see her mom because of the pandemic. Right. She gets to visit her through the course of the book, I think one time, maybe another time we see off the page. And she says, in the middle of the book, you say a daughter had one singular power to comfort her mother. So we're focusing a lot on how she can provide care and solace for her mother. At the same time, mm-hmm. she is a mother and she's not with her children, and she doesn't mm-hmm. really, you don't sense she has the same relationship with her daughters. So I wanted to ask you about this idea of motherhood and the difference of being a daughter and a mother.
I think that she, at least in the context of the novel, the protagonist feels like the burden of care has been, well, this is never stated. But my feeling was, you have this protagonist who cares for this mother who is ill and has been ill for a very long time, and that the cost, the toll has been for her extreme and too high. There's too much care that she's had to. It's disproportionate with what she's able to do. And I mean, I think that that's not uncommon. I have this conversation with plenty of friends who have parents who are aging or who are ill and who clearly need some sort of additional care, can't just stay at home. And then the question becomes, what do I do? to help my parent, or how do I help my parent through this stage of life? So that is a kind of care, but it is very different than caring for someone who's small and who's growing up and hopefully is very future oriented. So they're related, but they're kind of different. And I think I was trying to shine a light on that. You know, how rewarding is that? We're told that caring for others is rewarding. Caretaking has traditionally been the role of the woman. And I think this protagonist is sort of living in this space of not really wanting to be the caretaker, but having these roles. And maybe some of what she has to learn or has to go through in the course of this novel is to look at the process of care slightly differently in order for it to be a role that she's able to take on or a role that she wants to take on again.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting I don't even know if it's a duality, it's just holding so much paradox, that if you are a mother, you are also a daughter. Like, just by being born in this world, you exist as a daughter, and you might become a mother. And how you hold both of those things, because I felt like her relationship to being a daughter and being a mother could almost be two people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are probably people for whom that's not the case, that there's a more seamless relationship, but the protagonist has this other party in her relationship with her mother, which is the specter of illness that has been part of their relationship. And that illness is only intensifying as the mother ages. And then you have the pandemic, which enters into the story. And so illness takes on even greater role in their relationship. And that can be a challenging relationship to navigate when people are sick, because sometimes you are able to relate to the person who's just like they themselves. And sometimes the illness is affecting the personality of the other person. It's a lot of persons in a sentence, but hopefully the meaning gets across. And then that makes a relationship, or can make a relationship, even more challenging. So there is like the specter of illness and what that does to a relationship. I think that also impacts the way that they interact with each other. And she doesn't have that with her children. Neither of her children are ill, but she is sort of exhausted in a way.
And it's interesting to think about if her kids could have the power to comfort her in the same way that she has the power to comfort her mother. I mean, it's a different generation. They're growing up in a different culture. But I thought it was really interesting to think about that, because she's having both those relationships simultaneously. And she's distant from both physically.
Yes. Right.
But different.
And I think part of that also, again, is because illness has affected her relationship with her mother. It's affected her relationship with her body. I mean, there's a point where she talks about that, I think, in the novel, not in like a really heavy-handed way, but that's sort of one of the things that she's grappling. This is like a facet of the novel I haven't really talked about, but when you become a caretaker, not for just for a person who is aging, but a caretaker for somebody who has some sort of physical disability or an illness that's worsening, it really does take a toll on the caretaker. And we talk about that a little bit in the media, but that's sort of what you see going on, that it's this illness is always like another party that's present to this relationship.
Do you think that's what made her so open to, we eventually learn the tree doctor's name is Dean, open to Dean in her life? I mean, I don't necessarily think she was like the type of woman who came to California thinking, oh my God, I'm free, I'm going to have an affair. It just kind of crept up on her, but she was also porous.
I think of it as there are any number of forces that all happen to come together. And I think the piece that you can never account for in relationships with people is chemistry. And so I think that there is some sort of instant chemistry with this person, with the tree doctor, that opens a door that she wasn't expecting. And if she hadn't had that sort of chemistry with him, then it might not have happened. It might have happened anyway. But I think that when you have overwhelming or powerful chemistry with somebody, you can be led to do unexpected things, or things that you don't see yourself doing necessarily. I mean, this is true of even like a charismatic leader, like somebody who's the leader of a really charismatic religion. They can get people to do things that they might not necessarily do. But there's like some sort of X factor there for their particular relationship. And so that is a piece of it. And I think it's impossible to unravel precisely all of the reasons why. You can't necessarily say this is why this happens. I mean, there's a point at which it just is simply something that happens.
When you started to write this book, did you know that it was going to be, you know, there's a lot of sex in it, which, you know, we can talk mm-hmm. about writing sex scenes. And there's a point, I think, where your character talks about how people sometimes avoid writing sex scenes. But there's mm-hmm. also this healing notion to all this. And I'm wondering if that was something that you wanted to bake into the book, because it is very erotic.
Absolutely. In the original conception, I mean, when you talk about like what was in the first draft and what was kind of layered in afterward, that piece was there from the very beginning and in the initial drafts and in how I conceived of it.
So tell me more about like what interested you in this the healing nature of that.
Well, I mean, I was writing it during the pandemic, and so I was sort of thinking, what could I write about that would be the opposite of the pandemic? And that would be somebody engaging in something, in some kind of activity that was incredibly life-affirming. And so that's how I saw this.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. And so tell me about writing this. Like, you had commented in there about people avoiding, I mean, writers can avoid all kinds of things. It's not just writing about sex. They can avoid conflict. You know, Charles Baxter has an amazing essay about writers avoiding difficult situations. So I'm curious, mm-hmm. If it was hard for you to, when you initially started this,
No, it was not. But partly because I had decided, oh, this sex is going to be a big part of this novel. I mean, there was years ago, somebody had said something to me like, you know, well, you don't know how to write sex, or you can't write sex. I think there was like a panel that I wasn't allowed to be on because I hadn't written about sex and didn't know how to write about it. And I was sort of pissed off and thought, well, okay, well, one day when I have an idea, I'm going to write a book that has sex in it. And then I had an idea, so then I wrote it. You know, like it was not, oh, I don't know if I can do this or if I can't do this. It was clearly, oh, well, this is part of what this novel is about, so I'm going to write these scenes. There were things that were more difficult to write about. It was very interesting to me. My editor, for example, wanted more scenes with the mother. Those were painful. Those I didn't enjoy writing. And because they were painful, I know I really was trying to write something that would be an antidote to the fear that certainly I was feeling in the middle of the pandemic and that I imagined other people would be feeling. So writing about a woman having an affair and having sex and enjoying herself seemed like a really nice antidote. But leaning into some of the more painful emotions, I was worried would overwhelm the novel. My editor said, no, we need a little bit more from the mother. Can you explain more? Isn't it obvious what's happening here? But those scenes got highlighted and drawn out more and expanded. So that's something that was emphasized more later. But the sex scenes really, by and large, were in the first draft and were intentional. And I thought were the kind of the focus of the book from the very beginning. And it's, for me, it was one of those, well, if you're going to write about sex, then write about it moments. It wasn't, let's just write a little bit, or let's hint at it happening. You know, it was, if you're either in or you're out, and I was in, and I was committed to this as a subject. So I wrote the scenes.
You know, she lives in this very fertile area. Like, her yard is very fertile. She has trees and grasses and flowers and vegetables. And that seems, I mean, thematically, that kind of goes right along with the sex. But it's,
yeah,
there's also, you know, he is a tree doctor. He comes in to help her with some rare trees that she has, and helps some problems that she has with some of these trees and making sure they live. And one of the trees in her yard is kind of a mystery of how it got there. And mm-hmm. you write so beautifully about the natural world. And so many people have described a sunset. So many people have described a flower. When you are writing about that, how do you think about approaching it that helps you write something that feels fresh and evocative?
Thank you. I definitely don't say to myself, how can I write this in such a way that is fresh? I definitely think, I sort of think, what am I seeing? What am I feeling? And then I try to describe it based on what I'm seeing and what I'm feeling. And that's really kind of the simple process. It isn't necessarily, I mean, I guess every now and then I might have some awareness of something as being trite, or thinking maybe somebody has said that before, but that editorial voice is generally not in my head. It really generally is, what am I seeing? What am I feeling? And then let me put that down. To your question, that means if I'm looking at a cloud, I'm not thinking about how have other people described a cloud, or how might one describe a cloud. I'm really just asking, you know, what am I seeing in this cloud in this moment? And then trusting that that is going to be specific to the way that I see it. And then it comes out in text. Actually, when my agent read the very, very first draft, she was one of the first readers, and she said, there are too many flowers and too many plants and too many birds. Can you please remove some of the flowers and plants and birds? So I went through, and could we have the sex happen sooner? She said. So I removed some flowers and plants and birds. I can't even remember now what it was that I removed, but I mean, there's a really raw scene that happens when the tree doctor comes to visit her for the first time, and it's mating season. And so all of the birds and all of the animals are mating. The goldfish are having this kind of orgy on a plank of wood in the pond, and they're like five fish and they're all having sex. And she can't tell, you know, which one's male and which one's female. And I think she says to herself, well, this is really sort of embarrassing. And I probably had been out in the garden myself and seen the goldfish engaged in an orgy and thought, wow, if someone were here, this would really be sort of embarrassing, but that, you know, there was nobody there. So then I just sort of tried to put that in the scene when in my imagination, somebody came along on this walk with an unnamed protagonist and thought, well, you know, how would I describe this? What are all of the various things that I've seen birds and animals do, and how might somebody respond to those various things? And so then that's, you know, that's how I ended up constructing that whole scene, which ends with two hawks. One hawk has killed a small bird. The mate of the dead bird is screaming, and the hawks are plucking the dead bird and eating it. And then they have sex, and it's very graphic and raw. I had never seen anything like that happen in nature before. I think that there's something cultural in Japanese, and this does relate to the tale of Genchi. I think there's something cultural in Japan where there's a belief that nature does express something about human feeling. Because in the tale of Genji, there are hundreds of poems, and they're love poems. And very often the feelings, emotions of the lovers are expressed through using birds or flowers. You know, the way the dew is falling, or the way the flower has wilted, or the warbler has lost its mating call because now it's autumn, and I miss the time of spring when the warbler could sing with this mating call. So there's like an intrinsic belief almost or just an accepted practice that nature accurately reflects human emotion. And when I kind of like step outside of myself and think about my mother, she was like, there's so many Japanese people who are like that, but my mother was definitely like that and probably gave that to me. And so I think probably very much trying to enter into that headspace when writing this book. So I wasn't thinking, how do I describe this leaf in a way that no one has ever described a leaf before? But I probably was thinking, how does this leaf make me feel? What human feeling does this leaf make me feel? And then how do I write that? So that would have been the thinking process. There's a class that I taught on nature and nature writing, and there are two famous poems that I'm not prepared, so I can't remember what they are. But the one is a poem about a leaf that's growing in a wall or a flower. It's a flower growing in a stone wall. It's an English poet who goes and picks the flower and examines the flower. And, you know, there's like a very scientific process that happens here where the flower is removed from its environment and then dissected and described in the poem. And there's like a companion, I think it's a haiku, probably by Basho, who sees a flower growing in a hedge, and the hedge is like a wall. But the flower describes some sort of emotion that the poet has. And they're fun poems to read in conjunction with each other. It's kind of reductive, but it's also sort of interesting in explaining how one might approach something as simple as a flower growing in a wall, and how culture might influence the way that these experiences are reflected in their respective poems. So, Emil, like, I know stuff like that. And so I had that in mind as I was working on this novel. But I wasn't consciously thinking, and in this moment, what are the birds making me feel? It was really just sort of giving myself over to whatever the moment was and then writing it down. But if I were to step back and think about it, probably that's kind of the force that was at work on my creative process. This whole sort of like belief that nature isn't something that I observe, or isn't this pristine entity out there for me to walk through, but that it's expressing something that I'm a part of. So I gave myself over to that.
Well, I think too, that is what is so incredible about being human. I mean, I don't know what sort of imagination animals have, but that when you imagine things, you aren't just visiting something in your head. You are having a bodily experience. You are having an emotional experience. And when you're writing and imagining, it's like very holistic.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, and you can do that as a human. You can give yourself over totally to it. And yeah, I mean, that's what writers and artists like to do. And hopefully it comes through.
Well, that's what I was kind of thinking about when you were saying, you know, I don't look at a cloud and think about how someone else described it, is that every book, whether it's close to your life or not close to your life, is imprinted with your DNA. And your whole life that you've lived up to the moment of your writing is in it. It's even in every and that you write. It's like your singular fingerprint on this book, even though we're not reading this to know Marie. And so, you know, then you mentioned, you know, about your parents' love for nature. And this is like kind of an impossible question, but it's kind of like, well, how did you become the way you are? Like, how did you become interested in the things you're interested in?
I mean, I think it's pretty hard to fake genuine interest. So the one thing I can say is that I did have in the moment at the time that I was writing this, a genuine interest in all of these things that I was writing about. That's one of those secret ingredients to writing, I think. If you're just compiling information or reporting information or taking information and organizing it and then regurgitating it, I mean, that could be like, you know, that's what I did in high school. How do I take a bunch of ideas and organize them into five paragraphs and then make them logically connected and make an argument and then deliver that so that I can get an A? That's like a kind of writing, and it's a kind of thinking. It's a kind of organizing of information and a sort of hierarchical and logical structure. The way you might build a building, right? Here's the foundation, and then here's the first floor, et cetera. Creative writing is about something else, because it is about a way of seeing And at least for me, it's about a very sincere way of seeing. I don't know how to do it without being sincerely interested in something and then, you know, reporting back. Here's the thing that I have been sincerely interested in. I'm now sharing this with you. I'm not sure how to break it down further than that. You know, some of the deeper themes in the novel probably actually get closer to answering your question. I was wondering, well, what is, if you are attracted to this kind of like primordial life force, what are you attracted to? What is that? What is human sexuality? Because I don't know. It's fundamental to, or can be, you know, like there is something that I've really, something that I learned teaching young people, that there's such a wide range of how young people express human sexuality. I had students who would talk about being asexual, as there are in the novel. Students who would say, well, I'm demisexual. So what is that force? I mean, I don't know. It's a really deep mystery when you really probe it closely. So I had that kind of intense question in mind as I was writing this novel, that I just don't think we know what the answer is. And I also have felt like there's a change in how generations view sex. I feel like when I was younger, the kind of received opinion was you should have a healthy relationship with sex, which means always having sex. That is what it is to have a healthy relationship with sex. It is to constantly be sexually active and sexually engaged. I don't know that younger people necessarily think that, which I think is an interesting question. Well, then what does that mean to be engaged with sex and then to not be engaged with sex? Like, if you're not sexually active, should you be ashamed that you're not sexually active? You know, my answer is no. But then what is that force that exerts so much power over people? So that's like a question that I think doesn't even necessarily have an answer. But those kinds of questions, if they're forcing the narrative of a story forward, I think can be the sorts of forces that hopefully make a story really compelling and make it personal and unique, because now you're not just building some 5-paragraph essay, but you're asking one of these questions that's a real question, but also almost impossible to answer.
I'm curious because, I mean, generally America is an incredibly puritanical country that doesn't like to talk about sex, or at least in many, many generations are like, don't have it until you're married. Mm-hmm. And we have a very large contingent of abstinence and all of this politics around mm-hmm. sex. And then we're also an incredibly free country where anything goes. And you live in Japan. And I'm curious right. about this novel when you think about it being translated or being received in any other country. It could be Japan, it could be other countries. If you think that the general dialogue might be different around your book because of the attitudes in that country. I mean, Japan would be a great example because you live there. I can't really talk about if it gets, you know, translated into French.
Maybe. there is a very strong influence on this novel from The Tale of Genji and from Japanese culture as I understand it. You said just now that at least in America, we have a very strong puritanical strain and a very strong, so our conversations around sex can be, don't have it, wait until you're married, or don't have sex, wait till you're married, and then only have sex with the person who you're married to, which is like one way to talk about human sexuality. But we're also in the country of, you know, OnlyFans. And we're also in a country that, I mean, it is always so interesting to me if I have to go shopping for clothing here, because you're never away from, when you're buying clothes as a woman, this question of how do you dress so that you can put yourself somewhere on the sexual market, I think is like never removed from the question of what kind of clothing you buy. There's always this pressure to, where are you going to show some skin? How tight is this part of, you know, something that you're wearing? You've been in Japan, so you know the fashion tends to be much less body conscious. There aren't any crop tops. Clothing is much looser on the frame. there isn't the same pressure to constantly put yourself and your body on the market, even in a subtle way. Whenever I read fashion articles here in English, I'm always reading about, well, we borrowed this from the boys, or, you know, mix some masculine and some feminine. Like, there's this constant obsession and thinking about, how do I present myself? How do I present myself as confident in this very gender specific way, while retaining my femininity, which involves displaying oneself sexually. So as puritanical as this country is, it's also, I think, very obsessed with sex all the time, in a way that I don't feel. It's very different in Japan. But also, the dominant religion in Japan, or the indigenous religion of Japan, is Shinto. And this is like a gross oversimplification, but, you know, that is a religion that's based around the worship of nature, and it's animistic, so there are multiple deities. And so there isn't the same binary baked into the culture of, you know, gods and demons and good and bad and angels and devils. So those forces are missing from this novel, and they're intentionally missing from this novel, because what's acting on it, supposedly comes more from the Tale of Genji, which was written at a time when these folk religions of Japan were much more active. So there's a sort of like loose, I guess more of like an animistic, a set of aesthetics that's acting on the story and on the characters and on the imaginations of the characters within the story. I don't know how it will be received if it gets translated abroad, but I can tell you that that's what was going on in my head.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like where it ended was a much more like pluralistic place than where it started. I felt like your main character came to a sort of vision of her life and her family that encompassed much more ambiguity and many more ways of thinking about things than in a binary.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, I think it's so interesting. I mean, I think it does end with a lot more complexity, but I think that there's an element of that complexity which is very freeing for her. I mean, I can tell you that, I mean, I grew up in America. I grew up in the United States. I grew up in California. But there's something about this duality that exists in our culture that I've never related to. I'm aware of it. You know, I know that it shapes my reality, but I've never felt like it was truly directing me. I always felt like I was operating with a slightly different set of aesthetics. And I think that that probably comes through in the novel. And I remember years ago talking to somebody about animistic religions, where many things can be animated and many things can have animistic power. And there's an argument that some sociologists or scholars of religion make, that we're moving away from monotheism and more towards animism. I mean, I don't know, given the state of the world and given the wars that are currently being fought, if that's true. But this person said to me, the thing about animism is it is freeing, because power isn't just concentrated in one place. It's not like there's only one God and you have to submit to that God. And so that God is right. And you just have to admit that this one force is right. Which from my perspective can be a terribly oppressive way to live. I mean, it's the sort of thing that leads to incredible hierarchies, to a really patriarchal way of thinking. Like, I occupy this position within this hierarchy, and I have to recognize this hierarchy, and I therefore have to, anything I feel or desire or I want, I have to shut down in order to fit into my role within this superstructure. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but that's kind of how I look at that societal model. It's never really gelled with the way that I feel or with what I think of freedom being. And I would also say, you know, like, there's also a version of America where we have incredible freedom, where people can live in different ways and don't necessarily have to slot themselves into this hierarchical system that I've just described to you. And the best of America does preserve individual freedoms and individual freedom of expression. I think that that's when, for me, I mean, that's when America's working well. And so that, I think that also probably comes through in this novel, that she makes the decision that works for her, that allows for a certain sort of complexity, which gives her a certain sort of freedom. But it definitely isn't this hierarchical way of thinking that gives that to her in the end.
Do you think some of the reason why you look like you were never comfortable with the binary that you usually got in America? I mean, some of that is just probably how you came out of the womb. But do you think some of it is because you were exposed to these other cultures in your household?
I'm sure. It must be. I mean, it's hard to break that apart. But I mean, I'm sure my parents were not, my father was not interested in necessarily in societal norms or in preserving them or asking me to conform to them. My parents were very creative and very artistic, but you know, I mean, I live in the world, so I'm aware of societal norms and I'm aware of where power tends to get concentrated. So it's not like I don't know how the world works. I've just never been convinced that that's the totality of reality or that that's necessarily the best world or the right world for everybody, I guess. And as I've gotten older, I've realized I think I'm probably always searching for what is a reality that allows for people to live comfortably and happily. And you know, a lot of people ask that question, and where it gets difficult is around questions of like care. Okay, so we want to live in a world where everybody's comfortable and happy and able to express themselves. How do we live in that world? How do we create that world if we also have to care for everybody, and we have to care for everybody when they're small, and we have to care for people when they're ill and when they're sick? So that question is also behind this novel too.
Yeah, and I also think that maybe this isn't so much in your novel, but maybe that isn't a binary either of how we care for people.
Yeah, I don't think it is. Yeah. I mean, I think that binaries are very powerful. You know, do I do this or do I do this? Oh, I just do this. And you drive yourself forward. When you just have two things to think about, it's a very powerful way of thinking and of motivating yourself forward. You just keep picking one of two forks in the road and, you know, you go on down the road. It's a lot harder if they're like, this is like a really, I don't know, a very simplistic analogy, but if there are like five forks every time you come to a road, there's a lot more information to process, but that could also potentially be more freeing.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Can you read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influences you as a writer?
So I'm going to read the opening to Cannery Row by John Steinbeck. And this is one of my favorite paragraphs of all time. Cannery Row in Monterey in California is a poem, a stink, a grating noise, a quality of light, a tone, a habit, a nostalgia, a dream. Cannery Row is the gathered and scattered, tin and iron and rust and splintered wood, chipped pavement and weedy lots and junk heaps, sardine canneries of corrugated iron, honky-tonks, restaurants and whorehouses, and little crowded groceries and laboratories and flop houses. Its inhabitants are, as the man once said, whores, pimps, gamblers, and sons of bitches, by which he meant everybody. Had the man looked through another peephole, he might have said, saints and angels and martyrs and holy men, and he would have meant the same thing. As I read this, I realize, oh, this is an opening paragraph about binaries.
Do you want to say anything more?
But that first line about California being a poem, a stink, a grating noise, a quality of light, a tone, a habit, nostalgia, a dream. I remember reading that in high school and thinking, oh, that's my home. That's where I'm from.
Can you read something that you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft, or something you liked.
Okay, so, and this is tricky and hard and not funny. This is from The Tree Doctor. And this is after our protagonist has finally seen her mother in the care facility. So the protagonist is driving home after seeing her mother. She drove home despite the crying. The drive after this visit took 1 hour and 46 minutes. It had been predicted to take an hour and 53 minutes, but after crossing the Santa Cruz Mountains and descending into Moss Landing, the minutes evaporated. Soon she saw the wide open stretch of Monterey Bay. This was her home. How many times as a young woman had she come back here, landing in the tiny airplane that putted from San Francisco to the two-runway World War II-era airport in Monterey, craning her neck to see her parents on the viewing deck waving to her as she landed. That was before her father died, and before she had learned that, one by one, they would all die and that the lights in her life would wink shut. There was no one here now to welcome her, and her mother was never coming home again. She remembered the drive from the house up to the care facility and how for the last half hour of that drive, which she had timed to minimize hitting rush hour, but which had still taken 3 hours, her mother had groaned and whimpered and asked, "How much farther? How much farther?" She had promised her mother they would visit the house once she was well, but her mother was not coming home. What happened with trees that could not bloom? Did they feel this pressure too?
Tell me why you chose that.
Because it's in the section with the mother that, a longer section that people love, that I don't love, that was emotionally painful. But I thought I would read it.
Where do you write?
Wherever I can. I used to be really much more, I think, picky about my writing spaces until I had a child, and then I couldn't be as picky. But if I can have some quiet and computer and some nice lights, but even if I don't even have nice lighting, if I can just have some quiet and some space on my computer, then I get my writing done.
What do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I like to go walking to look for birds. So if I really need to feel transported, I will take my camera and I will go for a hike and go look for some birds to take some pictures or animals. Sometimes I take a small camera now, but then if I see a bird, I'm really sorry that I didn't have my camera. So I often take my camera with me. I love to ski. I'm a terrible skier. I'm a late in life learner, but I absolutely love skiing. I feel like it's one of the most transporting things that I've ever done. So I generally like to go out and do things like that.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
At the moment, I don't really have a reader. That's always changing. I don't know. We'll see what happens with this. If I write something new, we'll see. I'm not sure. I've had a couple of friends who I've given my work to in the past, and maybe I will share with them again, or share with my editor, share with my agent, but I'm not actually sure. I feel like I'm in a time of transition. So I don't know.
How have you dealt with rejection?
Not well. I feel like you asked me this last time. I would like to say that I have not improved. My feeling about rejection is that I don't enjoy rejection and that I allow myself to be hurt or sad. And sometimes, you know, the yuckiness of rejection is always up against my desire to write. So I want to write, I've been rejected and I'm hurt. And as long as my desire to write is stronger than the feeling of hurt, I can keep going. And sometimes feeling hurt by rejection overtakes the desire to write. And when that happens, I think, okay, maybe I'm done and I'll never write again. And then I wait. And in the past, this feeling of hurt has always come back down and the desire to write is stronger than being hurt. Maybe one day that won't happen and I'll just quit. I don't know. But at the moment, you know, I just sort of feel whatever it is I'm feeling. And in the past, the desire to write reasserts itself and sort of takes over all systems and I go forward. But that's how I've dealt with rejection, which maybe isn't the healthiest way, but it's the only way that I know of to deal with rejection. You know, rejection sucks. You know, the practical things that you do, like try to create lots of options for yourself. Don't, you know, put all your eggs in one basket. Don't, you know, your writing career can't hinge on like one essay with one editor. So, you know, all of that stuff applies. But there could still be some large feeling of rejection that kind of hijacks your nervous system, or at least for me. And then I have to wait and see if I want to write more, and then I feel hurt.
What is your favorite word?
I don't have a favorite word. I don't have a favorite word.
Thank you so much for being on the show and talking to me. I'm so appreciative.
Thanks so much for talking to me and for taking the time and just reading the book with so much care. And thank you for your question.
If you like today's show with Marie Mutsky-Mockett, author of the novel The Tree Doctor, check out our first interview on her nonfiction book, American Harvest. We talked about the subculture of itinerant workers that follow the wheat harvest to cut the crops, the Christian environment in the harvesting community, and finding the right tone for the book. You can find that interview in the entire First Draft archive of more than 450 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Just look for First Draft ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, books, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Anne Lamott, Steve Elmond, and Adele Waldman. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft, a dialogue on writing, a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.